Hello and welcome to the 81st episode of the Open Science Radio. And this one will be the concluding episode, the wrap-up episode of the events that we've participated in, namely the Barcamp Open Science and the Open Science Conference on the 21st, 22nd and 23rd of March, I think. And as usual, you have it already, or we had him already as a guest for the preparatory episode. With us is Guido.
Yes, hello from Kiel.
And of course, Conrad.
Hi there.
So, I think we've done it, we've done something similar in the last year. And I think it's always a good practice, I would call it, to kind of conclude these series of smaller episodes directly from the Barcamp and about the conference and to kind of look back and see whether we can see an overarching narrative behind these events. And I think both events have been quite successful. So maybe, Guido, maybe you can give us for a start your own impression on how the events have been going.
Yeah, thank you. So first of all, I have to thank again you, Open Science Radio, Conrad and Matthias, for your big effort and investments to produce all that podcast. That was really good this year again. And so this year it was really special because so every year it seems that the conference it's getting better. It's a good point. So that was the fourth conference, third Barcamp, and so this year we were in Berlin for the first time, and the first conference was under the naming Open Science, and both events were sold out 6 weeks before the early bird deadline. So it was 6 weeks sold out 6 weeks before the conference, and was also a few days before the early bird deadline. And I think two reasons. Maybe one reason is maybe because we switched to Berlin, and maybe it's a better location for such a conference. And also I think that in the meantime, a lot of things happened, for example, on the science policy level or on other levels in the context of open science. And yes, Klaus Tochtermann mentioned it in his opening statement that open science gained momentum. So open science grew to a broader event, a broader movement. And I think that's also and the fact that the conference had and the Barcamp also had such a big impact this year. So we are really, really happy, and I think we can conclude separately between the Barcamp and the Open Science Conference.
Mm-hmm. Let's give Klaus Tochtermann his own words, because we have a small snippet.
Yeah. I think this is one of the greatest achievements to attract such an international community coming to Berlin for the Open Science Conference. And I think one reason why we managed to attract so many participants is because open science gained momentum since the conference which we organized last year in Cologne.
So it actually was also surprising for you as the organizers that in between the 2 years, there were so many more people interested in participating in the conference, right?
Yes, of course. So we didn't expect it. We planned with about 150 participants, and at the end we were 220. And I think another point is it's important to mention it, that we really got more international. So Klaus Tochtermann said something about 33 participants from 34 countries, 220 participants, and this is really good. And also for me, it's really, really good that also the Barcamp was very international, contrast to the first and the second Barcamp. So everything was in English, and the last year or 2 years ago, some sessions were just in German because all attendees come from Germany. But this year it was completely international. So this is a good point. We are getting bigger, and we gain more importance, and we are becoming more and more international.
Yeah, which is cool. As you mentioned it already, let's focus first on the backend because it was the kind of event being before the conference.
Yeah. So the barcamp this year took place at Wikimedia. So I think it was a really nice location for the barcamp, and we expected in the beginning around 50, 60, 70 participants. At the end, we had 100 registered participants, and I think around 80 and 90 people were really there, and I think after 3 years barcamp, you can see there's always, you have an interesting mixture of different people with different backgrounds and contexts, and always around 50 people are barcamp newbies. That is an interesting observation. So that it's not that always the same people are there. So always, generally, often some people are curious and think, okay, I have to attend a barcamp and this is the first time for them. I think for this year, one observation, I think, one point is that we have some classical topics that occur every year. It's about open research data, replicable research, about metrics, incentives, and more about teaching open science. So also, one focus of the conference and also of the barcamp was open educational resources, and so we tried to bring also this into this event. And but this year was really interesting also that we had more prepared workshops, presentations. So we had a session pad before, as always, but this year around 10 or 11 sessions have already been proposed before the barcamp, and so some people really prepared different slides, or in one case they even prepared a complete workshop with an entire schedule. And this was really nice because we have a mixture between prepared workshops that are quite good organized before, and also some flexible and on-demand workshops because some people just want to talk about a topic. And this is what is a typical character of a barcamp. This was really nice.
I don't know if how you feel about it, but since the barcamp was also very well visited, I think Conrad and me, at least from my perspective, are kind of at the edge of what is possible, because it is basically what we do, and we have I think we have published like 13 episodes about the barcamp. It is usually you attend some of the sessions, and while we were still able to more or less follow the what was going on in the sessions last year, this year it was really, really hard because I was editing and publishing episodes during those sessions, and Conrad was also, I think, having his own session again. So the amount of sessions going on in parallel with all these really interesting people is kind of what brings us to our limit, what is possible in terms of reporting from the event, which is an interesting fact, because which is also a plus of the event itself, because you meet so many interesting people, and it was really hard to sit down and work on editing and publishing this episode instead of participating in the sessions or talking to people you meet on at the coffee table or something. So it's actually it was really interesting to kind of discover that.
we could have, I think we could fill a full year of Open Science Radio just with interviews of participants there and with their projects. So it was really rich on many different aspects. So I really enjoyed this a lot. So if the listeners are going back to the episodes of this, please be aware this is just a selection of this, and we're very sorry that we could not cover really the whole richness of this event.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have to remember for next year that we need another or two further persons that help you support your recording. So this year we had, instead of 15 sessions, also 20 sessions. I think that increased the load a bit. Mm-hmm. But it's really cool to have that, your short podcast afterwards. So I had the same situation as organizer. I couldn't also not attend all sessions or follow them.
Yeah.
But I think with this year we reached an upper limit. So I think 100 people is the limit, and we cannot allow that the barcamp is getting bigger. Because I think then it will lose its special familiary character.
Yeah,
right. So
I think we will cut the line and say, okay, 100 or maximum 100 participants. It's the maximum, and we cannot allow more to keep the barcamp character.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You had this year a female spokesperson for the Ignition talk, which was very cool. It was Anna-Katrin Bock. I think she's from one of the Leibniz research centers, if I remember.
Yes. And this, of course. So just link it. I can't remember the English name. It's GEI, German Research for Education. And I can't remember it currently. After 2 years talks from a man, this year we had a woman. It was good. She was talking about the role between open educational resources and open science. So Anna-Katrin Bock, she has a strong educational background, so more in school sector, but she was also able to reflect on both things. And I think this initial talk this year again was really interesting, because she pointed, from my opinion, so I didn't thought much about the role between open educational resources and open science before, but I think they have very much in common. And the core of both concept is OER in the education sector and open science in the scientific research sector is this concept of openness. And she started with an interesting point that today the acceptance of this concept of openness is not a technical problem, it's a societal and cultural problem. And she said that the problem is no one gives knowledge away for free or freely. So we don't have currently a culture of sharing. And it has many reasons, and one reason we already know, because our reward system is not adapted for that type of culture, because we have what she really pointed out very good is that the problem starts already at school, because school is very heavily based on it's a competitive system, it's a rivalry system, so reward the best, and it's not based on collaboration. And so that was her main point, that this culture of sharing must be taught at the very beginning at school. And when all these young people start from the beginning, as a culture of sharing has positive effects, and they perceive it at normal aspect of doing, when then those of them who are then going into the scientific system, so they already have the basic to be open. Mm. And this I think was for me the core of her Ignition talk. Bring open practices into the classrooms.
Mm.
And now it's the time for that, because the complete change with digitization and also educational resources have a good possibility to really practice to enable these different kind of Yeah.
At least at least there are less obstacles than we had to face like a decade ago, and all these tools we have at hand that can be supportive and that can enable these kind of aspects, more collaboration, more sharing, but also incorporating ideas of others and form your own ideas on top of these. I guess this is also something that that needs to be in use more widely, and that maybe also teachers need to become more familiar with, that taking ideas from others and turning them into your own by further developing them is actually an act of creating your own instead of just copying others. And I think that's mm-hmm. exactly right to kind of, it's about the time to bring this cultural change. And Absolutely. Wikimedia was actually so nice to record her Ignition talk and mm-hmm. Published it on their comments page. And we'll link to the video file in the show notes, of course.
Yes. And I think generally, so the topic Open Education Resources was not the most present topic in the different sessions, I think. But maybe two observations. So one session was just proposed, okay, I want to talk about OER, because I am curious about that. And so one session in that context proposed was about a MOOC. And then you can see where the difference is, because everybody... Well, it was a prominent topic and necessary to teach open science practices, and open education resources can help. But what I see is that in most cases, what they see as open education resources are actually not, because in the context that this MOOC session, the presented MOOCs are not open in that context. So I think that. You have a lot of educational resources that can be used to teach open science, but in most cases they have to take additional step to be really an open educational resources.
Or resource. Right. Yeah. In principle, I mean, this is a general thing that's already, you know, started also with software, right? I mean, if mm-hmm. people think, okay, I can freely use a piece of software, then they think it's open source or whatever. But this is just a question of price and not about the freedom to do stuff with this. And in the end, it's a question of licenses, right? So all the MOOCs, or most of the MOOCs that are around, they can be used for free. Basically, you don't pay for that, or, well, you can to get the certificate, but they can be used for free. But it's more about that you can take the content and reuse it and change it and not breaking copyright with this. And I think this distinction has to be made on several levels. Same with research, right? That you can use Google Docs or whatever to do your research and collaborate, but it's not necessarily open due to this. It's just what we said before. It's basically a technical level, but we also need to address the cultural level that we basically mm-hmm. And the legal level as well, that we basically make these things officially open and changeable.
Right. And
absolutely correct.
And there's a meta Etherpad that links all the various sessions and the single session Etherpads, where you can find like summaries inside and session notes inside. So we'll link the meta pad that is kind of a starting point for all the other pads in the show notes, so you can skip through the single session pads and have a look what was discussed, and then maybe as a compliment, listen to the small episodes that we recorded with most, I think, of the session people, the session moderators. And I think we can briefly go into two sessions that we picked that were kind of distinguished in a certain way. So we can more elaborate more on these two.
Yeah, I think so. So as I said before, many sessions are classical sessions, yeah, about maybe open data practices, open source, and incentives, and so on. And I think two sessions were somehow special. And the first session is, I think, I don't know. So far, we started with the session planning, and I think 10 or 12 sessions, or maybe more than that, have been proposed. And then one, I think it was a woman, huh? It proposed as a session about the title, why did only two women propose a session so far? So this is an interesting point, because the mixture of participants is 50-50. Mm. So we have 50% men, 50% women. And they started a session about, how can we, why is the reason? Why is it so? And how can we maybe foster that maybe more women want to propose a session?
Yeah.
And so they end up with three recommendations. So one recommendation was that the session planning is separated in two parts, so that we have two session plannings during the day, first session planning and then sessions, and then maybe after lunch or whatever, then second session planning and second session, so that some people may open up a bit, and because you go are there, you are new, and after 30 minutes you have to propose a session, so that it's maybe generally it's so maybe that may help, and they want that the committee itself. It of course a committee must be more diverse. So it's I think it's clear that all persons who are involved in the organization committee, that is also a 50-50% mixture in optimal way. And the other thing they propose, that you have to provide a more anonymous way of or free way to propose a session. So that were the three recommendations, and I still have to think about that, if we what we can do. I'm not sure if I would like to open the session planning with a statement, okay, and especially invite women to propose a session. I think that would also not be a good way. So I think, okay, this is a good observation, and it's still on discussion.
Yeah.
But what do you think?
But it wasn't as bad in the end. And I think that's right. What the session was proposed and held by Lucy from the Free Software Foundation Europe. And I think we did a short episode with her, and in this episode, she was also kind of beginning, I stepped forward and proposed this session. And afterwards, she wasn't sure whether she sparked this or whether these women were wanting to propose a session anyway. After her, a couple of women actually came forth and proposed their own sessions. And maybe this is just a problem of getting all the people going, or maybe it was kind of because of Lucy's proposal that others were encouraged.
Yeah.
But I think in the end,
she broke the ice.
Maybe. But I think in the end, the share between sessions moderated by men and sessions moderated by women was still not equal, but it was way better than only 2 out of 10. So I think it kind of was okay. And the ratio between men as barcamp participants and women as barcamp participants was, at least from my impression, kind of equal. I don't know if you have actually numbers for that, but I felt like nearly 50-50.
This is also my observation.
I mean, maybe this was just basically an undersampling, right? That we just had basically 10 talks or something like this proposed, or 10 sessions proposed, and then there was this bias in this one direction. But still, it was, I think, kind of important that you stepped in and made this clear also for future events, mm-hmm. that maybe it has to be paid attention to that. And independent of if this sparked it now or not, I think it's good to keep certain things in mind. And also this it's not only that, let's say, women are maybe having more issues with this, but that also other people might have problems being shy, and this is why a separation in the two sessions might be actually when two parts of the day might be not bad. So one in the morning, and then maybe when some people warm up, they also feel more comfortable with suggesting stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's right. It must not be a gender problem generally. So also because some people are more shy and so they need a time. And maybe you attend the barcamp, you are new. Then you attend a barcamp and the first session is over. And then you gain some ideas about right. some further sessions. Maybe it would also be okay that we plan most of the session, maybe 80%, and 20% of the session slots will be kept free so that they can be proposed after lunch or whenever to bring those people also opportunity to. So sometimes it's so you attend 1, 2, 3 sessions and you think, okay, yeah, that is a topic I would really would like to talk about. And then it's too late for a session proposal. Maybe that's a good point.
It might be also, I mean, also for newbies, right? People who not experienced the setup of this at all, maybe they need 1 or 2 sessions to get to understand how this works. And then they feel comfortable with starting their own ones. So I think it's a good suggestion. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
Then let's talk about the other session that we wanted to look into on a more detailed basis. Which was simply due to the fact that it was A, interesting when it comes to content, B, very well prepared, and C, also very well documented. And this was a session held by Bianca Kramer and Jürgen Bosman. I think both are quite well known inside the open science scene. And they held a session on the open science practices across across the full workflow, and wanted to discover whether it would be or what would be the entry stages in order to open up this the practices and work along open methodologies and all these kinds within the science workflow or within the research workflow. And they did a very well job because they put a lot of effort into the preparation of this session. They prepared cards and had like this pin walls up where people could attribute cards to certain workflow steps. I just had it on the site and I recognized it on the site. But did anybody of you participate in this session?
No, unfortunately not.
Yes, I was. No, I attended, cool. And it was really. First of all, it was really funny to see because the last preparation they did at Wikimedia. So they sat in the floor of Wikimedia and they printed, I don't know, 50 papers, 50 slides, and cut it out and everything. So it was really good prepared, and they had a clear objective. So that they want to pin out open science practices that are early to adopt and that they have a high impact. So and so that they prepared a workflow consisting of the phases, the scientific workflow, preparation, discovery, analysis, writing, publication, and outreach and assessment. And with all of them, they prepared some open science practices that they already collected. And so then it started that we had to extend these existing practices for the different workflow phases. And then we had to pick out those what we think that are they're easy to adopt and have an high impact. And then we there was some group phase. So that we formed different groups and each group picked one workflow cycle and pick out all these open science practices that we already identified as easy to adopt and high impact and selected our top two and identified for these two selected practices where is the benefit for all scientific disciplines and where are maybe barriers or discipline specific barriers for a certain discipline. And so it was really good prepared and they really documented well their outcome. And for example, I was together with Marie Farge in my session, and we were in the, where is it? I think we were in the writing, but I'm not sure, cannot find it currently. I think it was, I think we were in the writing part, and the post small effort, high impact was, for example, citing open access literature and providing data code, so citing open access. Other open access literature that you said they gain more important, and it was also that that you deal with citing data, so that open data also becomes for more famous. That was our outcome for our small phases, but it's already it's documented in the current in the corresponding session pad.
Yeah. And we have a small episode with them, interviewing them on the next day about all of the activities they've done, because they kind of participated also in this session about the Open Science MOOC, and they did their own session, and they did another session, I think, on infusing traditional classes with Open Science ideas. So classes on training people in academic skills and in information literacy, and we're linking in this interview, in the show notes of this interview, we're linking all of these three session pads, and inside the session pads you will find they're very well documented kind of notes about the session, and also further links of for example, a blog post they've compiled after their Open Science Practices workflow session. So that was actually really fun to see how they kind of used the BarCamp for their ideas, to shape their ideas and to put across their ideas to other people, introduce other people to what they have in mind also with their summer school, because they do a 1 week summer school on Open Science and Open Scholarship in the Netherlands. I think this upcoming summer, though it was actually really fun to see that they really had something in mind when coming to the BarCamp.
Right. Very, very well prepared, and well, also clearly with an aim in mind.
Yeah. All right. Shall we conclude on the BarCamp then, before we go
awesome.
to the conference?
It was great.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, this is pretty clear. I personally like this format very much, and it was even, the number of participants was even higher, and I really enjoyed that there was so much activity, and I said I wish we could have catch up more of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, Guido, you already have set a date and a location for the next BarCamp, right?
Yes, of course. So I can say it now or at the end of the episode. So yes, there will be. So anyway, I think I have to add that. So we are really satisfied with the BarCamp, and we are also willing to learn. So some things have been proposed in a feedback pad, and we want to improve and to learn. But I think with a basic setting, next year it will be in Berlin. And we ask already Wikimedia if they want to host the BarCamp again, as it would be great. So the setting is perfect. We have to adjust maybe some things, and then we can do it again like this year. And the date is the 12th March in 2018.
Mm-hmm. So put the dates into your calendars and keep your eyes open for any early birds.
Save the date.
Oh, well, the BarCamp is free. Of course, there will be not something like an early bird offer, but you will be recognizing, hopefully.
You must be quick this year, I think. Right. Okay.
Cool. So shall we then go over to the conference?
Yes, sure. So the conference was also really good this year, and Klaus Tochtermann mentioned 2,000 would be great. No, 220 participants from 34 countries. So this year it was again as the conference before. So a major part based on invited speakers from the different domains. So this year we had half open science background, half open educational resources background, and open science background was mainly from EU representatives. So from the European Open Science Clause was presented at current state, Open Science Policy Platform, GoFair Initiative, and so on. And this year we also had two panels, of course. And this year we cooperated with the Open Up European Union, or the EU Open Up project. They had two workshops during the conference, and also we responded to the demands of the community to provide some more practical stuff during the conference. And this was done this year by the poster session. So we accepted 20 posters. They responded for the call for project presentation, and 18 have been presented. And I think also the poster session was really nice this year to have. And besides this different speakers that we also have an alternative and more interactive format.
In case you didn't know the Open Up project so far, of course we have a small episode where we interviewed Michaela from the Open Up project, and she gave us a bit of insight into this project, which is a Horizon 2020 project that kind of wants to come up with some kind of framework for the review and dissemination phases of research projects, and to, of course, promote open science more widely. And they have two major work packages. One is focusing on altmetrics, and one is focusing on the review and dissemination phase. And it's kind of really interesting. And these the two workshops, I think, were along these two work packages. So that was interesting to see.
Yeah. So maybe we start with general observations, and then we can go through some of the the presentations. Yep. So my general observations, I think it's about three or four. So first thing, currently on the European level, when they deal with open science, one major aspect are currently based on open data. And okay, also because the European Open Science Cloud is currently the very most prominent topic in that context, and also in other talks about open data, the people always refer to the so-called FAIR principles. This is findable, accessible, interoperable, reusable, and so it seems that these principles are currently widely adopted as the principles that have to be recognized when talking or when trying to bring open practice into open data into a product. And sometimes it was mentioned very often that open does not mean free. And in all sessions, so in the open science sessions and also in the open education resources sessions, and for me it was sometimes not clear what was the point behind that. So my impression was that even if data is in that sense open, you need infrastructure for that, and the infrastructure is not for free. So often they the term business models was mentioned also in that context very often, that you need sustainable business models that the infrastructure the infrastructure can be run. That was an interesting point. And third point, I think that is already, we already mentioned it in the Barcamp web app, that the openness barriers are societal and cultural and not technical, and that for both, for the open science community and also for the open education resources community. So one speaker of the open education resources section, he said that, for example, that currently teacher do not really work together in that context, in that open education resources context. And the fourth point is that I think that open education resources and open science, they have can grow together, but it's still in the beginning. There was also a panel about that, and all members of the panel said that this movement, or that both communities can work together, but it's at the beginning. And I think they have really much in common, because they have this similar concept of openness, but they have different definitions behind that. So in our case, open, it's when it's when it's reusable, when it's shareable, when you can use it, and it has an appropriate license and so on in the scientific context. And in the open educational resources context, they have the five R's, that is revise, reuse, remix, redistribute, and what was the fifth? I can't remember currently, but they have a really clear letter. So they have the basic idea behind everything, that you need a culture of sharing and collaboration. Mm-hmm. So in different contexts, collaboration in the education sector means collaborative creation of educational materials. And I think that open educational resources, they can be used in open science in the teaching aspect, and not only for scientists, but also for materials for citizens. And I think that is also an observation, that the citizen science aspect is growing, and you can reach these materials, educational materials, also to teach citizens to play a role in the context of citizen science, or just to create materials that they understand what scientists are doing. So that were my four major observations across the conference.
I think the fifth R should be retain, right?
Retain.
Because that is often one of the major issues in the long term. Of course, it's nice to get together and work on open resources for teaching and open content in general, and to provide it to others, to redistribute it so that others can reuse it, can revise it, can remix it, and use it on their end. But in the long run, one of the major problems is always to make it available and keep it available. So to retain it and retain ownership and retain that the content is available for access online, that it can be downloaded, then that it can be stored somewhere. Mm-hmm. It needs to be managed probably over time, because content, there's hardly any content that is always up to date. So content will outdate, and it needs to be updated, except for the Bible that has been there for like 2,000 years unedited. No, let's not go into this.
Maybe it would also need an update, but okay.
Right, right. retaining is always a big major problem, and it kind of reflects to one of the issues that we had in a lot of discussions and a lot of talks of the conference, which is providing the infrastructure, and not only the technical infrastructure, but provide the knowledge and the people able to directly deal with whatever we store there. Like these concepts of data stewardship was mentioned quite often, and yeah. The concepts of data scientists, in order to kind of manage these vast resources, data resources, and kind of open up access to these. So that's kind of a red line going through the conference as well.
Maybe I can add something to basically the price tag that many people try to put on stuff, right? We said open is not free, and this is very important. Maybe from a distant perspective, I mean, it clearly says we need infrastructure and we need also the funding for that, right? This is a rather high-level meeting, and there are decision makers inside of the crowd, and it is very important that it needs to be accepted that there has to be funding allocated in maintaining these infrastructures, doing the training that you just mentioned, Matthias, the training of people that they are capable of being aware of this issue regarding openness, and that all this has to be seen as an investment. Open is better because more people gain more from that, and it's very important for maintaining a proper scientific system. And the funding for this has to be given. And this is very important that it's an investment into our future, into a proper scientific approach, and also into teaching, into open educational resources.
Yeah. And it must also be a long-term funding. It was also mentioned during one talk, I think, that programs with 3 years project runtimes is not sufficient to run an infrastructure.
Right. Right. Yeah. I always see this parallel. I mean, in a university, nobody would say, well, we fund your library for 3 years or something like this. It's a part of the infrastructure to have a library, and we need to extend this to other things that are maybe not university-based, but national-wide or even European or maybe even international. Mm-hmm. Okay, so should we maybe dive a little bit into some of the talks?
Mm-hmm. I think we should concentrate on especially the first three talks, because I think there was a lot in there, especially if you consider what was said on the policy level.
Right.
That was really interesting. And I think the first one, of course, Klaus Tochtermann gave an introduction to the audience, a brief one, and he talked about the kind of development that the conference itself it took, especially from last year to this year. But the first speaker after Klaus Tochtermann was Jean-Claude Bogelmann, who is working for the European Commission, I think, as the head of the unit A6 in the Research and Innovation Directorate.
Yeah. So generally, Jean-Claude Bogelmann is the so-called mastermind behind the European Open Science Cloud. And last year, he presented the vision. And this year, he gave an update. So I think they are, their time frame to build up the European Open Science Cloud is really tight. So in my understanding, they want to have, I think the most important decisions are that they want to have an EOC web application that you can use already to check it, to test it in spring 2018. And they want to have some sort of running infrastructure in 2020. So I think it's in 3.5 years. And to do that, they are dealing this year with funding programs. So they're still running funding programs on infrastructure level, of course, and they decide on more funding programs in Horizon 2020, and it will be decided in October 2017. And there will be a so-called European Open Science Cloud pilot project, or there is a pilot project, and so they have a really tight schedule of different funding decision and governance funding phases beginning this year and ending 2020. And yes, as Matthias, you already mentioned before, that he also referred to the fair data principles, of course, and he said this is also often in that context that they always refer to open science by default, but they must be closed when necessary. This is, I think, in open educational resources, this is not a discussion, because that thing I never heard about open as needed and closed, open as most as possible and closed when we need it, I don't know if they have a similar discussion, but in our context, it's always referred to privacy data and business data and so on. And also he mentioned the role of an important role of data stewardship. We need people that can deal with data, and this will also be part of this funding program, I think. And yes, so I think two important points is that he also mentioned that they want to know what is the progress of open science in the European Union. So they started the so-called Open Science Monitor to see over the time what is what changed in the last years, and they also want to do more in context of open access, and they want to publish create a so-called open publishing platform. And I think for that you have also a snippet,
right? Because that is at least what we've understood, but let's listen to what he actually said.
Yesterday we will launch this year a publishing platform for open access publications, which is inspired, if I may say so, by what the Wellcome Trust is doing, but we would like to offer this also as a potential alternative or a potential complement to the existing outlets for open access publication, as for those publications emanating from the work which is funded by the framework program. Yesterday.
So it's actually really interesting, because that is one of the main topics that were within last year's conference. I think Marie Farge was mentioning that explicitly last year already. She said that we actually need to look into a publishing platform or publishing services that is in the hands of something bigger than just corporations. And if we kind of get to the point where where we can actually establish one that is publicly funded and that is held by an institution that is bound to the legal but also the moral rights of being a publicly responsible institution, that could be something that countervalues the open science movements that's coming from the business, from the publishing business itself. So that's actually really interesting, and I think it gets more concrete over time.
The point is, you mentioned this before, we are not quite sure what he meant with this, right? And I try to ask him, and I tweeted him or sent him a tweet, and he did not answer very precisely. He also said there will be more announced soon. So I guess the impact of such an infrastructure would be tremendous, right? And I guess this is why they handle this rather with care for the time being, because as you said, this will impact dramatically on publishing industry and others. There are examples like this with Cielo in Brazil, and there are other things like this, but nothing has taken off so far. But if the European Union started such a platform, this would be huge. And we hope that we still got him right in respect to this. So I'm very looking forward to what this really means.
Yeah, and the question is how it correlates with the European Open Science Cloud, so that it may be easy to connect publications, text publications, with published data material and vice versa. I don't know. So this is really an interesting point. But I agree that if they really start a central platform, open publishing platform for all European projects, that would be really great.
And I guess he gave kind of a very significant hint in saying that this could be something equivalent to the Wellcome Trust, right? The Wellcome Trust that kind of built this research library, this overarching research library. So we'll see.
It has been even taken up by Nature, right? I mean, there was even a news comment regarding this. But yeah, well, they're just quoting people being there. It's not so concrete so far, unfortunately. Yeah, but this was actually not the only thing he presented. There was something very concrete. This was basically the Open Science Monitor, right? Maybe Guido, you can tell a little bit about this.
Yeah. So far, I could only inspect the Open Science Monitor very quickly. But generally, it's the idea is that they want to know more about the current state of open science in Europe. For example, and for that they created three groups of information, or they call it characteristics. It's open research data, open scholarly communication, open access to publications. And behind that, they defined some subgroup. For example, for open access to publications is, for example, open access publications, preprints, alternative publishing platforms, and so on. And if you go to an indicator, you can see different metrics behind that. For example, percentage of publications from each year that are open access. And you can, for example, see what is the difference. They collect the data from different sources. For example, this percentage of applications from each year open access are from OpenAIR. And there's a difference between gold open access and green open access. You can see that of course, green open access is more than gold open access, but I think that, but it's not a representative metric. I think they have also metrics. Yeah, for example, the number of preprints. That is interesting because that is differentiated between all member states, and during that metric currently Germany is on the top regarding number of preprints that are archived, that are, for example, all preprints that are in archive, WPAC, BioArchive and PeerJ, for example. So that you can also have an impression over time what is the current state of open science in Europe, and you can compare member states. So that maybe also brings some pressure on the member states to do more in open science or in open access in that case, for example. And you have the same similar metrics, for example, for open data and other metrics. So the thing is, I'm not sure, I didn't inspect it in detail, but there was also a discussion on Twitter then how open this monitor is itself is. Is the data behind that is collected, it's also open, or is everything behind that open, that you can really see the method, how they collect the data, how they calculate or aggregate the data, and so on. So, but I think it's a good starting point to start with something and to see. So what is, so currently they don't, it's only a monitor to see what happened, but I think they don't, no important decisions are currently depending on that numbers, but maybe in 5 years we have a different situation.
But I think that one of the most important aspects is that it actually is a monitor, because monitoring means constantly trying to evaluate what's going on, constantly having a look on the current trends that are already existent, but also trying to keep track of what might be coming on top of this. And I guess this is kind of a nice place to have this in one place, in a more or less very understandable way. And you have already a lot of material inside this monitor, especially the documents behind it. And so it's not something bad. Of course, there's room for improvement, but hell, well, improvement is, I guess, the natural process that is inherited in all science, right? So nothing bad about this. What I found kind of intriguing is who actually did it. It's the RAND Corporation, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not called the RAND Corporation anymore, but it's RAND Europe. Mm-hmm. Oh, it actually is RAND Corporation, but it's RAND Europe. And RAND is something that I always find suspicious. I don't know why. Maybe because they also had their business in like satellite development and were working for NATO and did have strings to the US military and all this. But they were kind of founded in the late 40s, if I remember correctly. So it's actually a really interesting organization to look at. And I have to say, all of their research, or at least like the majority of their research, is publicly available in their own library. So you'll definitely find a lot of valuable information in publications there. So just to let you know.
Yeah, it's a good point. So the European Commission, they ordered the RAND to do this.
Yep.
And interestingly, so in the context of the Open Science Policy Platform, they have also a working group with dealing with altmetrics. And so as far as I know, there was no collaboration on that. And this is also seems a little bit weird because you should also apply open science practices when you're talking about open science, was a statement of a panel during the conference about this working group. And but it's a good starting point and goes into the right direction. But the background, so we will see how this thing will develop in future.
Right. Shall we go to the next speaker, who was Johannes Vogel? Most of us will probably know him as being the head of the Leibniz Institute for Evolution and Biodiversity Science here in Germany, and the head of the Museum für Naturkunde.
Yeah. So he has both. He's both important positions. So one is, okay, he's head of this Museum für Naturkunde, you said before. And and they host the conference dinner. Yeah?
All right.
We sat beside big dinosaurs.
The skeletons, yeah, right?
Skeletons, of course, not living skeletons. Yeah, yeah.
The meat was on the table.
So it was beside a really impressive conference dinner location, and he's also in order to guide the European Commission and in order to give input on their doing, they created the so-called Open Science Policy Platform. So the European Open Science Policy Platform is that big gremium that that guide, advise the European Commission in their open science agenda. And he's the head of that group. And so in his talk, he talked about two things. One thing was about generally the Open Science Policy Platform. And the second thing is about, so he is also head of a so-called European Citizen Science Association, and he's very, really heavily engaged in citizen science and citizen science project. And from my point of view, it was really interesting that he mentioned that it is vital for the future scientific system that citizens are more involved. And so for him, he pointed out that citizens, they need, he called it, they need a so-called scientific literacy. So they must be able to engage in science on different levels. And scientists need to understand that citizens want to engage, and they have to give them, they need to do more to teach the public about their science and to involve them more. And this was really interesting because, so I think the movement of citizen science, it's growing, And we have also, for example, a so-called GWIS platform in Germany where you can find different citizen science projects in Germany. And so most projects are currently based on crowd-based data acquisition, I would say. They're collecting data for them. They measure something, they count some animals or whatever. And what he wants to is that citizen science play a bigger role in agenda setting and a bigger understanding on what is necessary for the society, what type of research is necessary or what is necessary for the better of the society. And he going farther than that, and he said that is this new engagement of citizens in research is not only a current movement. It's a key for the future success of the scientific system. So we need to engage the public. Otherwise, we will within a deep change. Otherwise, we will have a slow death. That was his statement, and this was really, really interesting. And besides that, he also presented the Open Science Policy Platform, and I think for both of them, you have appropriate snippets.
I mean, the idea of involving citizens into science and providing enough information to them that they can be educated properly on what goes on in science and why science is important is basically a very old idea with the public understanding of science. This kind of movement, especially in the sciences and the humanities, like this push, there was this push memorandum that's basically there for like what, 15, nearly 20 years now. But of course, with the more sophistication of citizen science and the more awareness of that, this might be something where you can not only push information to the public, but actually engage them and let them be part of this. And by this, giving more value to them as being part of science is becoming more and more increasingly important. And I guess that's what he also kind of put into his talk and made it very clear. And yeah, we have two small snippets. And let's, before we go to the death, let's go to the Open Science Policy Platform and what it actually is and what's the role of it, because I think that's one of these more abstract things that might be difficult to put your head around. So let's give it a shot.
So, Open Science Policy Platform brings stakeholders and knowledge communities together, and as I said, translating knowledge into policy recommendations. So that means once we formulate these recommendations, we will discuss them with the EU Commission. The EU Commission will take them to the Intergovernmental Competitiveness Council. From there, it goes into the member states, and hopefully if we square this circle, we might end up with open science principles underpinning the next framework. But again, this is a challenge for you. You need to talk to your governments, 33. You need to talk to the organizations in your country so that this becomes also their will, because they will be engaged in the negotiations on the principles of the next framework. So don't leave the work to the OSPP. It might be a bit short. It needs to be a much, much broader movement, and you need to act as multipliers.
What I found interesting about this is how complex he actually made it, or how clearly he made it how complex it is, right? This string of argumentation that needs to be followed in order to finally come up with something that is policy relevant is what actually is really interesting about this Open Science Policy Platform, right? And as a second, you already said it, he ended kind of his talk on a very dramatic note, as is his natural. I always think of him as a person like David Attenborough in the first Jurassic Park movie, like because he's so he has so much energy about his topic, and he has so many ideas, and he's also able to put it in a very narrative and dramatic context, which I like. So this is his like ending note on participation, either participate or be damned.
So why do we need innovation with participation? I think society wants it. Science definitely needs it. There are plenty of open minds, 300 or so in this room. Advances in technology and communication, you are driving that, but think about it, how best to do it. Science needs to find new ways of working. What are we going to get? Probably a sustainable life for humans on Earth, a scientifically literate citizenry that doesn't want to fund anything but the European Open Science Cloud, dynamic adaptive societies, because the world is changing faster than we care to think, open innovation that engages science and society. And if we don't, then here comes the evolutionary biologist, but this is also a slogan coming out of economy. Deep change or slow death, these are the two options, and I'd rather be on the deep change side, and hopefully you too. So thank you very much for your attention.
Right.
Yeah, really good point. And so interesting is that in his talk that he really points out that citizen science is a vital part of open science. So he says open science also means open science can only work if you engage citizens, in his mind.
Yep. Which leads us somehow to the next speaker, which was Barend Maunz. And he's, besides his medical background, working at the Dutch Tech Center for Life Sciences at Leiden University, he was also head of the high-level expert group of the European Open Science Cloud, but he's not any longer. He stepped back from being the chairman of the of this high-level expert group, and he said something that was very revealing to me. He said, now that I'm actually stepped back from being the chairman, I can speak freely. And that was really, really, really refreshing. And he did have some very, very sharp points, I would say.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It was great to listen to him. Actually, my favorite speaker from the whole conference.
Yeah, fully agree. So I think from his background, before the Open Science Policy Platform was created, before that the concept of the European Open Science Cloud already existed, and there was a high level expert group on the European Open Science Cloud. And he was, as you said, he was the chairman. And for example, Professor Klaus Tochtermann, he was also in this group. And beside all this really nice statements on the science system in general, his role was to present this so-called Go Fair initiative. So on the one side we have the top-down European open science policy stuff that make some policy decisions that they have advisors from the European Open Science Policy Platform, and they put it into funding decisions. On the other side, there is a movement, so it's called Go Fair initiative, that want to do. They want to do some things for the European Open Science Cloud on the member states level. So in small projects, in practical steps, and so on, and they want to do it on the infrastructure level, on the educational level, and so on. And he wants to propose the idea of the Go Fair initiative. And fair, of course, refers to the fair principles. And I think you prepared 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 snippets. Mm-hmm. And I think, we can go through it. So his basic idea, or what he pointed out, was so currently data loss is real. So he said that about 80% of data that we create in science is lost one day because it's not stored in a good way. And yeah, but then he came to the point that open science issues are, as we I think we talked about it already two times in our session here, that it's not a technical, it's a societal cultural problem. And you have a snippet for that.
Right. It was nice to see the BarCamp and the conference coming together in this, because this was one of the first issues mentioned in the Open Science BarCamp by Anne-Katrin in her Ignition talk, that that this cultural sharing or the sharing act, the act of sharing, is actually a cultural and a social issue, and that we have to get this into the head of people, especially those working later inside the research system. And it was nice to that he pointed this out very, very clearly, and let's give a listen to it.
Now, first, we have really defined in our report a number of major issues, and we said 80% of the problems to get to real data-driven open science are social and not technical, so cultural. The first one is that now that we have big data and radiculograms, as you can see them on the screen here, people just dig their head into the sand and get reading again and look at databases without being able to deal with the complexity that the computer reveals to us in big data. That is one of the big problems, and specifically people that became big scientists by reading in the data sparse era, where a Nature paper is about the best you could ever achieve. Secondly, this is one of the major problems, and it became very clear during one of our stakeholder meetings. We now need, let's say, as biologists, as the lady with the microscope, we need data scientists and data stewards, and we don't understand them. So the big fight between the e-infra people and the S3 people, as you call it in European terms, you know, the S3 people charge it a little bit, say, oh, these guys have never built anything we can use. And then the e-infra people say, if we ask five biologists, you get six opinions. So they never get, and the high energy physicists, they speak with one voice, that's why they get all the money, that's another sideline.
I love how aggressive his example is, and of course it's not as drastic probably in many cases, but it, you can follow it quite clearly, I think.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned the role of the important role of the new, think, job type called data scientist or data steward that must be more prominent in future, that we need means to deal with all this big data and you also indicated that it's hard to the big data problem, so you have a lot of tools and environments you can deal with big data, but I also heard, I was not sure in which talk it was, you can find any correlation in big data you want. So this is also an interesting problem, that so you have big data, you have to analyze it, but is the data really show some new sign from the scientific point of view, or how can you really trust the analysis and the calculation steps behind all these calculations?
Yeah, right. Where do we gonna go next? It was really his talk was like one thing after the other, and he did mention so many things that it's probably hard to put them into context within our own episodes.
But just start with the silverback, and we just start the the snippet.
Right.
Everybody liked that, right? Everybody liked that part.
Yeah. And unfortunately, his slides are not on the conference website yet. Maybe they will be, because they were also pretty cool. Because he had a guy doing drawings for him, and most of his slides were less text and basically just some sketches. Basically in the manner of PhD.
Yes.
This comic series.
PhD comics, yeah.
That would be good, because they were nice, and he had some nice comic characters in there. So basically what he was referring to him as a silverback, is that we have a lot of very, very experienced people sitting on very important positions. And that the current system within the research world is still supporting this kind of status quo by building on scholarly metrics that are at least worth discussing, and that in these in the process of the personal life and the professional life of a scientist, like going higher, becoming more professional, becoming senior researchers, becoming or getting tenure professorships and all this kind of thing, that this the old scholarly metric system is still too important in the whole recruiting process, and that we actually should look at this detail in more detail and be open enough to change this and put this into more, maybe also more reliable basics. And he can say it much better than I can. So let's listen to him.
And then the worst of all, maybe, is the reward system. Luckily, we just got a report from one of the working groups on altmetrics. And I always told them the silverbacks, it almost cost me my professorship, but okay, that's fine. They sit on the rock, they think age factor, journal impact factor, nature, tables, figures, text. That's what you became big by. The young scientists, they have their virtual reality, they have FAIR data, they go over 20,000 databases, but the ladder is broken. They cannot make a career, and certainly data stewards that do not have a high age factor, I deliberately always say age factor instead of age factor, they never get up the rock. And these guys, mostly guys, I have to say, sit in the review panels everywhere. They stop open science. And I'm getting a silverback myself by now, so I can say it without, And then the worst of all is that this is a professor and a Harik in a one. Because if we get big data, we can get any correlation we want. So I am now using this usually to say PubMed, our database of 40 million articles, contains considerably more crap than Wikipedia.
I think that was kind of the point that he wanted to make, is how important it is to actually get data scientists into positions where they matter. And to have people in the more higher positions be aware of that they actually need these personnel in order to make sense and to make proper sense of all the data that is there, right?
Translating data into knowledge, basically.
Yeah, right.
I would love this.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, of course. And
we'd love to see this more, yeah. Very important points.
Yeah, he really, yes, it was a series of good statements in all different aspects. That was really nice, and also in a funny way. Huh?
Yeah.
As he really liked it. Yeah. The age index is currently an aged index. Yeah. An aged index, and this is fully true. Yeah. So,
and he said that it is not that it is not enough to actually have the FAIR data principles there. You have to have the personnel to actually bring them to life, and it's not enough to have them as principles. What we need to do is transfer them or convert them into standards being widely applicable. And that's, I guess, the next statement that we have from him.
Now, in a we published this FAIR paper in 2015, and you see that it's wildly read, cited, and so on. I made this slide last week. It's 84 times cited already now. So lots of people say, hey, FAIR data principles are good. But let me say a few words about it, because they are principles. They are not standards. So it's very easy for the G20 and the G7 and everyone to accept the principles. That's deliberately why we make the principles. But now we have to make choices to implement standards and best practices and everything according to the FAIR principles. But we have to make choices for ontologies, for TCP/IP type things in the internet, and FAIR data and services. So the work only begins now, and it's indeed, as was said, your work.
They hear it. I mean, it's in converting these principles into standards that are widely applicable, you also need to think infrastructures and services at the same time. He gave the TCP/IP example as being something that was similar, right? In the days when the internet was developed, or the web, World Wide Web was developed, building on the technical infrastructure that was enabling this net to grow and to develop. And he put this into, we just heard the beginning, he put this into something that is, at least from my end, clearly understandable. Let's give a listen to it.
Politically, we have a very strong commitment to FAIR principles. But we have to make choices to get FAIR data and FAIR services. So what we really want to achieve is what we called in the high-level expert group report the Internet of FAIR data and services. So the trains, the workflows can find the data can find the workflows, and we can do our real modern science on across disciplines and everywhere. That's the dream. And we said if we want to follow the Internet approach, and we had actually George Strong, the first director of NSFNet, where the Internet started to boom, on the team, not of the high-level expert group, but on the FAIR team, and I'll see him this week, later this week in New York at the World Economic Forum, who have also completely accepted the FAIR principles, and he will give a speech how the trick was done. They decided to take TCP/IP and domain names. They didn't tell anyone else to do the same, but they had enough critical mass for everyone to start to use the same minimal principles, which are in the middle of the hourglass. So if we try to make a fat belly approach where you do all kinds of top-down standards, it will never work. That was our conclusion. So we say minimal international guidance and governance was also the only serious criticism on the report. Oh, there's not enough about governance. Well, we don't want a lot of governance. We want to make some very deep choices and then have maximum freedom to implement to create a globally interoperable and accessible thing like the internet, but now for data and services. And it should be a commons.
Nice statement at the end. Yeah. It should be a commons. That is kind of the core point of the justification of it being open, right?
Yeah. So we need. I think I'm not sure if he said it explicitly in his talk, but his example was the internet, and the internet. The success of the internet is not based on principles. It's based on some core stable standards, and on everything is built upon that. And this is also his point. He called it Internet of FAIR Data and Services. So we need some core services and standards and some core standards and also core services on everything can, which is stable, and everything can build on it. And that is really a good point. And that brings us to the next point, interesting point that he said, that to do this, we need some good long-term funding for, of course, putting infrastructure projects.
Right. We need the right personnel, and we need, of course, the funding to back it up. And this is what he had to say.
Yeah.
What happens in 18 months from now? Oh, you will go for a new NIH grant. What if you don't get it? Well, we die. That's criminal. How can we build an internet of fair data and services if very crucial things like ontology mapping services and Uniprot and all these databases in my field, that if they go down, we lose? And all these resources have to go through a near-death experience every 4 years to get a new grant. This is very wrong. So if you want to build this rocket launcher, it's not rocket science, but if you build rockets and you don't have a rocket launcher in place, they are still futile. So we need to get a little bit, I think it's less than 1% of the budget, to keep these very basic core infrastructures and core resources up and running. And then we said, one of the major hurdles is we don't even have data stewards who know how these things work and who can bridge this gap between the domain specialist and the nerds.
I love his directness. It's just, yeah. And again, sorry, this is a bit biased and we have like 5 quotes from him and only 2 from the others, but he brought it to the point in a very non-political manner. And I think that was so brilliant about his talks. I never had somebody address like this hunt for new funds in order to continue a project described as being something criminal.
And it was very refreshing to hear from some. It was very refreshing to hear from somebody like him, especially, right? It's not, you know, you're not sitting in a pub and you're just discussing this like we would do. No, he's very high level, and well, he said finally he can even tell this also so bluntly, and it's very refreshing hearing this. And I'm very happy that he was and is in this position to push these kind of ideas forward. And I guess it will take a moment. It will take a long time actually to overcome some silverbacks, but it's he's basically really pushing this in the right direction.
Yeah,
of course, and also truly really interesting that he said so that currently there will be no funding problem. So at least he said only 1% of all funding should be go into the infrastructure, and he also said if we do more efficient science, we can easily use the savings. to invest in this funding. So that is really nice. And one core is also to, yeah, for example, if you have good data stewards and we don't have to recreate a lot of data, basically on that amount of use of data, so the savings of don't recreate data, it's an important financial aspect then.
Yeah. At the same time, he was very clear that that maintaining data, providing data, storing data is actually expensive.
Yeah.
And costs just a lot, huge amounts of money, but it is definitely worthwhile because in the long run, we can make the best out of it.
Mm. So, and he's now in the position to bring this all a step forward. So he's, as I said before, he's in the GoFair initiative. And so he named it as it's a bottom-up approach to implement the European Open Science Cloud, or in his term, the Internet of Fair Data and Services. And I think, so the Netherlands, so they had the European Presidency 2016, and they had this conference in Netherlands that gave them, on the one side, a big audience, on the other side, they... a big step on the of the policy, on the political level. And so they have an interesting GoFair activity program in Netherlands. And yes, I think you should put the link into the blog post for this talk here today, for mm-hmm. this podcast, and so that other people can inform what happens currently in the context of GoFair in Netherlands.
Mm-hmm. Will do.
Yes. And I think we can mention that in the context of GoFair, there was one project presented, the so-called GERDI project. This is so-called generic research data infrastructure. It's a project that addresses the problem that we have a lot of so-called long-term small data distributed on data on hard drives and local storage devices and whatever on local servers, and they want to bring all this data together in an yes, generic infrastructure in Germany in the first phase in Germany, and so that you have a single point of access to all this data. So to bring this data in a data storage that is describe it with metadata and everything, so that it's a federated approach that different data storages are connected somehow. And this is, for example, this is a contribution by Germany for the GoFair program. So and that. Mm-hmm. To understand the talk by Professor Arndt Bode. He's from the Leibniz Supercomputing Center in Munich. Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe, okay, time is running out a bit, I think. So then there was also a panel by the European Commission Expert Group on Altmetrics. So beside all the European Open Science Policy platforms, they have different working groups, one working group for Altmetrics and one for Open Access, for example, and the Altmetrics group, they finished a report and they published it this year. And so there was a discussion about that. And I think just read the report, the really interesting points of recommendations. And the most important point is that we need a new metric system, of course. So we need an additional metric systems. So there's no metric system that works perfectly, but we need new systems that address better open science practices. I think that is already known. And they talk about so-called responsible metrics. So the thing is, they call it measure what matters. So you have to find a way to measure the correct things, to have the correct decisions. So what you really measure, what you really want to know. And you also have some sort of disadvantages if you apply metrics in an incorrect way. So that was the one, sum it up into one sentence. We need responsible metrics. A responsible way of applying metrics for the future system, so that that really are used in a responsible way. And the second thing I mentioned before is that it's wondering a bit that the Altmetrics group wasn't somehow not aware or not involved in the creation of the Open Science Monitor. And this was the last really interesting statement of Isabella Peters. She was moderated this session. That if you make recommendations on open science, please use open science methods as well, mm-hmm. because the Altmetrics group should be have involved into this open science monitor, for example. Mm.
Which is probably just a organizational problem, because I think the creation of the Open Science Monitor was also a project that was related to providing funds, having all the grant application processes, and that might be the
problem. I think it's a system problem, but it shows also that you cannot. That it was also already mentioned last year at the conference, that you talking about open science, you cannot apply current methods on these new systems. You have also to apply new and open methods. And for example, maybe the creation of the Open Science Monitor should have been more open. Yeah. The process behind that, maybe. That is a good point, I think.
Before we come to an end, I think we mainly spoke about the first conference day, which was heavily focused on the Open Science Policy Platform and the Open Science European Open Science Cloud and projects related to it. And we have also done a couple of recordings with the participants of the poster session. So if you're interested on which kind of projects were introduced or presented via the poster session, we will link the hashtag where you will find all the recorded episodes we did with them, a couple of very interesting ones. And maybe before we close, we should shortly speak about the second day, because what was the main focus of the second day was the relation to open educational resources.
Yes. So Yeah, we have, unfortunately, we have no recordings from the second day because, you know, Open Science Radio only attended the first day. Maybe we should change it next year. I think we go briefly through the different talks. So it was four talks, more than four talks about open educational resources and also a panel discussing the role of open educational resources in open science. And so generally, so what we mentioned before is that so I think they have a big similarity between open science and open educational resources on the openness aspect. For example, we have maybe the open definition that everything must be reusable, shareable, and so on. And they have the five R's. And also in the open educational aspect, they are often referred to the so-called, it's open but not free. Even then, if you have open educational resources, you have a must have an infrastructure and a platform where you can share, where you can collaborate, where you can store all these resources. So open educational resources can regard it also as some sort of research data if you want. So we need also an infrastructure for that. And I think so. The most important aspect of open educational resources that was also mentioned during the talks is that it's a good means to make knowledge available to all people in the world. So that is not a cost factor, because then you are that all people can have knowledge and have access to knowledge. It's not an inclusive good, that is a common good. And so I think this is a really big relation between open science and open educational resources. And one thing I can point out, it was a talk from Professor Dirk van Dam, is he said currently we don't have to be clear what open educational resource is. They must apply to the five R's. And he said that most stuff on the web is not an open educational resource. And the most MOOCs that are currently exist are rarely an open educational resource. So I think that currently we have a lot of materials then can be used for educational purpose, but they do not apply the concept for open educational resources. And the second talk I want to mention is Professor Marco Kals from the Open University in the Netherlands. I think this it's the one side he said it's a good point to also integrate citizens. So it's not only the teacher or companies that they create educational materials are involved, also citizens to invite to create an open educational resource to share their knowledge. And also a thing, but I think applies for both open educational resources and also for open science, that there still is some things are under have to they are under researched. That is the impact of open educational resources. He said there are no studies which show a direct correlation between open educational resources and innovation. And often an argument for open educational resources it improve innovation, but there is no proof for that. And I think the same counts also in some aspects of open science. If they say open science makes you from your intuitive point of view, you say, of course, it makes better. Everything is free and or it's open and you can accessible. But where's the positive impact that you can really measure? That the science it's better or science it's more efficient? So I think in both communities, you have this term of openness, and it's a growing number of people that say, okay, it goes to a good direction. But there's some evidence missing that it's really better.
Mm.
And right. No, this is a commonly raised issue. For example, for Open Science, Daniel Mitian always, since several years, he really would like to basically a scientific proof for the higher efficiency. And this is something that we are still missing, and it has to be applied in different fields as well, right? And same here for the open education resources. We need hard evidence generated following the scientific method in order to really show, well, this is the way to go because it has a high return of investment, basically.
And it's interesting to see that both concepts like open educational resources as well as open science in general are on the policy level basically on the same point right now. We have the Open Science Monitor started in the open science world as being the kind of try to look and evaluate what's going on various strands. And on the open educational research side, we have activities such as the Open Educational Resource World Map or the German Open Educational Research Info portals that try to do something similar, to look for what's going on, what are the activities, what are the persons involved, so the basic stakeholders, but also the gatekeepers, what are the initiatives, what's to be found where. And I think that's basically a good starting point to get these two concepts up on the map and give it a certain awareness so that also research can actually discover a grown and increased research interest. And maybe we see now a couple of research projects focusing on these aspects following up. Hopefully.
Yeah. Correct. So let's come to an end.
Let's come to an end. yeah. Anything to say to give it kind of a conclusion? I mean, I recognized something that I didn't expect before the events, because it was really, especially in the barcamp, but also in the conference, it is really hard to actually bring open educational resource and open science together. I can understand that they somehow belong together and that it makes sense to look at both in a similar manner, but it's actually really hard to put them together. On the conference, we have seen that the first day was heavily focused on the European Open Science Cloud and open science in general. The second day was heavily focused on open education and resources. There are hardly talks that actually put both really together, and not only put them together in one talk, but to actually interlink and connect them. And it was also the case, at least for me, on the barcamp. Whenever we had sessions touching both, it was really hard to stay in both topics and not fall back into one or the other.
Yeah, absolutely true. So I think it was good that both community were invited and there were attended the conference. So first you see what happening in the open science context, or mainly open data context, and the second day, what is the current state of open educational resources community. And you can see, okay, they have different problems, or sometimes also common problems, that's share problems, that's the same problems. And we are looking forward to the same, we have the same context in the core, that is the culture of sharing and collaboration, for example. And from my point of view, I think this open educational resources can play a big role in the context of teaching open science practices and involving citizens. But there was, on the first day, there was a panel, and there was 5-4 experts discussing about bringing this together and from different perspectives. And all of them said, okay, there's a big potential, but we are still at the beginning. So maybe the conference was some sort of starting point to think about that and maybe to collaborate and cooperate in different projects, different scenarios, and maybe we will see how this will come, or how this will develop in the next years.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. talking about next years.
Yeah. So, first of all, then I can conclude. So, both events were really good. I really enjoyed it. So, of course, then I have to thank all participants, clear, but I also have thank you, Matthias and Conrad, to Open Science Radio to be with us on board and to produce this huge amount of podcasts. So, and maybe we will find a solution for next year to clone you somehow, that we can produce more on that.
So it was a pleasure.
Then, after the conference is before the conference, so we said before we have dates. So, yes, see you next year in Berlin. Save the following dates. Barcamp Open Science will be on 12 March in Berlin and maybe at Wikimedia again. So we already asked, but so far I didn't got an answer. And the Open Science conference will be on the 2 days after the Barcamp, so it will be March 13th and 14th March in Berlin. And yes, so next year, I think, I don't know actually what the real focus will be, but I think one thing is that we want to try to invite some communities that are using communities of the European Open Science Cloud, so to bring some more practical aspect into the conference that we, okay, now we have talked 2 years about European Open Science Cloud, now give the using communities a voice. What do they think and how do they use it and how do they see what happening there? Mm-hmm. So then,
I think from our side, it was again a pleasure to participate. It was really interesting to meet all the people in the Barcamp or at the Barcamp as well as at the conference. For us, it's always a bit hard because the conference is again a two-day event, and at least for me, these kind of activities are my free time. So I have to take holidays for this and get some time off my job. So it's always hard to attend all 3 days in a row. But there might be a solution. So anyone who is willing to participate in making these recordings for the Barcamp or maybe even at the conference and who's planning on going there anyway, let us know beforehand and maybe we can figure something out that we have more help at the Barcamp or at the conference next year to even better accompany these two events and make more recordings and give those who could not attend even more insight.
Yeah, that is a good point. That bring open science practices into Open Science Radio.
Exactly. Okay, it was really a pleasure, and I'm really looking forward to next year's events. Thank you very much. Yeah. Guido, and we'll see you soon, hopefully.
Yeah. Es hat wieder Spaß gemacht. See you next year.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.
Bye.